Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Helen Crane. And coming up, fix for 5 years, lock in for two, or take a punt on a tracker. The great mortgage gamble that more than a million families must take. So what should you do? Also today, the top 50 house price hotspots. Does your area feature on our definitive list of neighbourhoods where values have soared? Plus, the UK stock market is cheap, but will investors who back it finally get luck on their side? Ask our Simon. Crane is back on the case, this time in search of hundreds of thousands of lost Avios points and the unlikely cars becoming classics in 2023. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, more than a million people come off their fixed mortgage deals this year, leaving them facing a rather tough choice. They'll likely be paying much more soon after the Bank of England raised interest rates again last month for the 11th time on the bounce, driving up the cost of borrowing. So, do you lock into a long-term deal or hold out in the hopes that rates will come down in the near future? Experts are calling it the great mortgage gamble. I think they're just calling it a mortgage gamble, but I like to ham it up a bit and call it the great mortgage gamble. Helen, what is the current picture?
Sure. So I think you've got to feel kind of sorry for anyone who's needed to remortgage in the last year or so, because there's been so much change. If you look back to 2021, mortgage rates were at historic lows, going below 1%. But in the last year, they've really ratcheted up. So particularly since September last year and Liz Truss's disastrous mini budget, which I feel like we always come back to on this podcast. But one of the main effects of that was mortgage rates really spiked. So around September, October last year, the averages were around 6%, 6.5%. So really high. They have come down a bit since then. So the averages today on a two-year fix, it's 5.32%. And on a five-year fix, it's 5%. But they're still much higher than they have been for around 10 years. So that leaves people who need to remortgage in a real dilemma. Do they fix for 2 years in the hope that when they remortgage again, rates will have gone down? Or do they perhaps think rates are going to continue to go up and they want to fix for 5 years? So it's really tricky for anyone who needs to take out a new mortgage at the moment. They essentially have to take a gamble on where they think rates are going to go. Generally, the theory at the moment is that rates are going to settle around 4 to 5% for the next couple of years. But as the last few years are showing, you just don't know. People have got to take a bit of an educated guess.
Give it to me in terms of pounds and pence. And obviously, it depends what mortgage you've got, how long you've got left, et cetera, et cetera, what you've been paying at the moment. But we're talking hundreds of pounds a month extra, aren't we? Or could be.
Yeah, absolutely. So this time last year, for example, the average rate on a two-year fix was 2.65%. Today, that's 5.32%. So that's around a doubling. So, for example, if you were someone who had a £200,000 mortgage on a 25-year term, fixed 2 years ago at that average rate, you would have been paying £912 a month. If you had to remortgage today onto another two-year fix, again, at today's average rate, that would be £1,207 a month. So that's almost £300 more a month, or over the two-year fixed term, that's £7,000. So it is big sums of money. There are cheaper rates available. For example, people who've got large deposits, the best rates around at the moment are hovering around 4%, maybe a bit lower than 4% if you're taking a five-year fix. But it's a lot of money every month for most people who are having to remortgage.
Simon, we're 4 months into the year. We've already seen hundreds of thousands, I think, of people who've come off their fixed deals. What sort of pattern is emerging already? What are they doing at the moment?
Well, interestingly, in a complete about turn from people's normal behaviour, we've seen people choosing rates that are actually slightly more expensive. Generally, you see a scenario where they go for the lowest possible rate, and that's what's led to the continuing popularity of two-year fixes before recent times over five-year fixes, because the two-year fix was the cheaper option. That's flipped around recently, and now the five-year fix is the cheaper option. But people are taking more two-year fixes. They're opting for two-year fixes. And that's because they're hoping that rates are going to come down and that in 2 years' time that we're going to have passed the top of that curve and rates are going to be back on the downward slope. Exactly to what extent that is true will be something that pans out over the next 2 years. I can't look into my crystal ball and tell you exactly what's going to happen. But as we have discussed on the podcast before, the forecast is for rates to have gone up like a rocket and then to fall like a feather. They are not forecast to do a quick up and then straight back down to where they were. We had something from the IMF this week saying they think that rates might have to be cut right back down to low levels. But that's a reasonably outlier view. The general view, and certainly the view of the Bank of England, for example, is rates go up, have gone up sharply. They're then going to stop, they're going to plateau, and then they're going to come down gently. And they're not going to come down anywhere near as far as the 0.5%, 0.1%, 0.25% base rate that we've seen since the financial crisis.
Helen, are you concerned that there's a tipping point here, that we might see a lot of defaults, or have the measures in place, the regulations in place, been stringent enough, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the sense is it doesn't seem to be a huge concern. I think perhaps there will be a small rise in defaults. As you said, though, after the financial crisis, banks were forced to put in a lot more sort of safety measures. People take out mortgages, you know, it's very difficult to get an interest-only mortgage, for example, now. You know, we're not seeing things like 110% mortgages and things like we were back in those days. So the market is a lot more stable. Also, I think another reason why there isn't necessarily that fear is that the environment's a bit different to when we were going into the 2008 recession. So the employment rate is still relatively stable. Wages are continuing to rise. So it's not quite the same environment as we were in back then. I do think personally we might see a rise in people downsizing or maybe buying cheaper homes than they otherwise might have done as a way to kind of keep their mortgage payments in check. There were some Rightmove figures out this week which showed there was a big rise in the number of people buying flats. They said that there was a 10% rise for buying flats compared to 2019. So I think there might be a bit of caution in terms of people, you know, being a bit careful to not overstretch themselves when they're buying a new home and, just kind of being a bit more careful. I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, the really big homes that people were buying, especially during the pandemic, when everyone wanted to kind of move out of cities and get more space, it wouldn't surprise me if those kind of homes maybe struggle to sell when people go to sell them on, because there's just a bit more caution about people overstretching themselves on their finances.
Simon, what's your view? Because if you have to shoulder another few hundred quid a month on top of everything else that we're facing at the moment, it seems, I don't know, the straw that would break many a camel's back, wouldn't it?
Yes, and I don't think we've seen the full impact of that yet. I think there is a general attitude that we've managed to escape the worst of what are substantial mortgage rate rises for many people. But I think that for many people, they haven't actually filtered through yet. And I would question how many people can afford to find an extra £300 or £400 a month on top of spending and bills that have already gone up. I mean, the good news is that hopefully our energy bills might come down at some point over the rest of this year, but they're still, you know, they're still at their highest level. And so they're only going to be coming down from there. And B, they aren't forecast to come down by that much. So you've got people who are spending, you know, another £100 a month on their energy bills. They're probably spending another £50 a month on their food bills. They've got all their other costs of going up. Broadband, I mean, why not raise that by 16% or however much it's just gone up by recently? All of these things are ratcheted up the pressure on household finances. And then if you stare down the barrel of an extra £200, £300, £400 on your mortgage on top of that, it's an awful lot of money to suddenly have to start trying to find. So I don't think that we've fully seen the impact of that yet. I hope that people do manage to soak it up. I think the fact that there are a lot of homeowners who aren't mortgaged in this country now helps. But on the flip side, there's also a lot of renters who are enduring an awful lot of pain from high rents at the moment, and rents that are going up quite rapidly. And so they're seeing that pain as well. So I think the overall economic picture is one where I don't think the pain is all the way through yet. I think what's interesting with the mortgage scenario is that there is an element where a broker might tell you that you should take a two-year fix because you could try to remortgage in 2 years and rates are high at the moment, so better to try to remortgage when rates are lower. See, that is in the broker's favour because the broker then hopefully picks up some repeat business in 2 years' time. Now, a mortgage broker, you know, good quality independent mortgage broker is giving you financial advice that should be solid, solid mortgage advice. And they shouldn't be swayed by the potential for commission in 2 years' time. But there is always that question in people's minds as to how much of that goes on. But, you know, there is a logical argument perhaps this time around for doing it, whereas maybe 2 years ago there wasn't a logical argument. The problem we've got is there's an awful lot of people who bought houses 2 years ago because there was the pandemic boom in home buying, the stamp duty rush, all that kind of stuff. So there's going to be a lot of people who are staring down the barrel of it. And just like one more thing on it is that there was talk a few months back of take a tracker, wait, and then when rates come down you can lock in at a better rate. Trackers with no early repayment charges, which is what you need, they're not that cheap. They're more expensive than the fixed rates at the moment. I'm looking at the moment for on our mortgage finder at This Is Money. And if you want to go see how much it would cost you, go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder. You can put in your own details and you can see what kind of mortgage you could get. So if you looked at a £350,000 home, a £200,000 mortgage on it over 25 years, and you look at a variable rate mortgage with no early repayment charge, the best you're getting is Nationwide's base rate plus 0.24% for 2 years tracker. And that's at an initial rate of 4.49%. Whereas if you flip that back to fixed rates, the best option you're getting, but then you've obviously got early repayment charges, is Halifax offering 3.79%. There's naturally not a huge difference in the monthly payments. That Halifax deal is at £1,033 for those numbers, whereas the Nationwide one comes in at £1,111. So it's an extra £70 a month. It's quite a bit, but it's not a huge, huge difference. It's whether you know, the great rate gamble, as you said. What do you think you should do? And it's just added another lottery element into owning a home that we really don't need.
Absolutely. Helen, finally, any tips what people should be considering if they are coming off a fixed deal this year?
I would say definitely talk to a broker. Obviously, as Simon said, maybe take it with a pinch of salt if it seems like they're trying to really steer you into a two-year fix for their own kind of benefit. But it is normally free to speak to a broker because they take their commission from the lender. They'll be able to give you decent advice, and also just plan well in advance so you can actually secure a new mortgage deal up to 6 months sometimes in advance of your current one ending. And even if you do lock in a deal, you can sometimes change it before the start date. So there is more flexibility than people sometimes think, locking into a mortgage deal ahead of time. So yeah, give yourself a bit of time, get some good advice, and just take some time to think about where you think rates might go, and make sure you do the sums. As Simon said, you can do that on our mortgage comparison tool on our website. So yeah, do your sums, get some advice, and do it in good time.
There's one thing I'd add to that as well, which is that lots of people end up with quirky mortgages. For example, they end up with two bits of their mortgage fixed over different periods because they borrowed some extra money to move home and they moved their existing mortgage with them, or they might have borrowed some extra money to do some home improvements or whatever. And mortgage lenders, I think, do their customers a great disservice here, because they don't make it easy enough for them to align their fixed rates and when they will end. And they don't fully explain to them the consequences of that. And the consequences of that can be that you end up in this never-ending circle of fixing and then discovering that the other bit of your mortgage doesn't end at the same time. And then that ends, and then you fix that, and then you just keep going round and round and round and round and round. So people go, okay, well, I'll just pay the standard variable rate for a while and then I'll get them together. But if there's a reasonably big gap there, the standard variable rate is much more expensive than a fix. That can end up costing you a huge amount of money. Now, I think mortgage lenders are doing people a great disservice here because it's very damaging to their finances, because it can lead them to making bad mortgage choices or ending up with problematic mortgages. It can lead them to paying much more than they need to. It can lead them to being stuck with the same lender. It can lead them to, you know, ending up with that never-ending circle. When in all reality, it doesn't make any difference to a mortgage lender whether they lend to you over a 2-year fixed period or a 19 or 20-month fixed period. Mortgage lenders could, we're in a quite sophisticated, you know, world nowadays where most stuff doesn't work like that. Mortgage lenders could quite easily work it so that they run fixes to the end of other fixes for people and maybe even vary the pricing slightly. So if you are a borrower in that situation, then think about that before you make any decisions. And that's where it really pays to have a good broker and start asking those questions of, what do I do about this? What are the implications of it? How do I get myself out of the scenario where I feel like I'm stuck on this mortgage hamster wheel?
Right, we're going to be sticking with our homes. And as you know, I love a good house price story. Dear listener, I really don't. This is why I don't love it, famously. Because, for example, last week, Halifax said prices were unexpectedly up 1.6% annually, while another survey from Nationwide claimed they had fallen 3.1%, the biggest drop, no less, in 14 years. It is confusing, and that's just two of them. There's tons, all the time, everywhere. But one thing is for sure, many pockets of the country have seen a property price explosion in the past decade. So is your area one of them? Simon?
Right, so Hamptons International ran these figures based on the Office for National Statistics data. So that's the official house price data, which is based on land registry sold prices. So it's not mortgage figures like the Nationwide and the Halifax or asking prices like Rightmove. It's the closest you could come to the official stuff in this country. And Hamptons ran those numbers for Money Mail and This Is Money. And they looked at what has happened to property prices over the last 10 years. And you're absolutely right, Georgie. If you zoom in over the short term, then house price indices will regularly give you contradictory information. For example, how much does the Nationwide House Price Index and the Halifax House Price Index reflect Nationwide or Halifax's respective outlook to lending to people at any given time, because it's based on their mortgage figures. So if Nationwide is tighter with its mortgages than Halifax, then you would think that Nationwide's index would show a greater house price fall. They say that this doesn't happen, but you know, there's questions like that around it. But these are actually sold prices. But what it shows is the sheer volume at which house prices have risen over the past decade. And there are some areas where they have more than doubled. There is actually one area where they have fallen. So where do we think house prices have risen the most over the last decade? What would be top of your list of potential places?
I reckon, from a low point percentage-wise here, I reckon Manchester, Derby, or East Midlands, is that there?
So,
East London.
East London, yep, right, you got it there. Waltham Forest. Right. Which encompasses Walthamstow, okay, which, you know, that area of London has seen house prices go up substantially because it was an area that was close to other areas that were more expensive and was cheaper, and that has led through to lots of people moving there and buying there, and that has driven up prices. Hastings.
Right.
Thanet.
Right.
Yeah, again, areas that are benefiting from having comparatively lower house prices and seeing that moving out effect of, you know, from London into the suburbs that then pushes people out of those suburbs further out and then just keeps pushing people further out. Barking and Dagenham, again, the East London effect. And then we start moving further afield. The city of Bristol, Northamptonshire, Medway, Rochford, Thurrock, Basildon, and Tameside, Trafford, Swale, Newham, Stevenage, Manchester, Southend-on-Sea. Every single one of those places has seen house prices more than double, or wow, at least double, in the last 10 years. I mean, you can paint this as good news for those people in those hotspots, but it's not really, is it? Because in all reality, the only way that this is good news is if you're planning on selling your house and moving somewhere else, which is not what most people do. Well, in fact, if they want to sell their house and move, they normally want to move to the same area into a more expensive property. And the way that mathematics and the property market works is that not only does mathematics mean that that means more money if you've got the same percentage rise, but the way the property market works is that it actually means a greater percentage rise, because in most cases, it's the larger properties that have gone up by more than the smaller properties. So the only people winning here are the banks and building societies that get to lend the money to the people who have to pay double the house prices that they were paying 10 years ago.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, my geography, Simon, is famously very poor, even though I've lived in many parts of England. But many of those on the list are seaside towns. And I remember back in the day when I was a jobbing BBC reporter talking a lot about the economics of seaside towns and how they'd, you know, fallen by the wayside. How will this translate to benefit those towns?
Well, you see a degree of gentrification. Does that benefit an area? There's some debate about that. I mean, gentrification can be taken as it can be taken in many, many different ways. But two different ways you can take it is pushing out the people who already live there, or you can take it as making an area a nicer place to be. Mm. I lived in an area of London that had been gentrified to a much greater degree than it was, in near Finsbury Park, right? And now I remember, in fact, full stop, London, okay? I remember London when I was a teenager and it was pretty grim in most places. It's not the same place nowadays. It's very, very different place nowadays. And I'm not just talking about the posh bits in the middle. But once you go out to those places like Finsbury Park, like Clapton, like Dalston, Stoke Newington, Walthamstow, Archway, and I'm just naming the bits within one small sort of northeastern pocket of London, but you could go west, you could go south, you know, and so on. They are arguably more pleasant places to be now. You have a better selection of, you know, shops and restaurants and pubs and public spaces, and the housing's been improved and all those other things. But that is at the expense of pushing out people who already live there, who now suddenly discover that they can't afford to live there. And you end up with the effect that we described. And that effect is made worse if you've got a large amount of the country all trying to move into the same sort of southeast London pocket. But what ultimately happens is it gets too expensive, and then people start to decide that they're not going to do that anymore. And I think we've already started to see that effect. We've definitely seen that effect in London, where people are going, well, I'm not going to move to London. Actually, the London effect is waning. There's a Manchester effect. There's a Leeds effect. There's a Newcastle effect. There's a Birmingham effect. There's a Bristol effect, and so on. And it kind of, you know, shuttles around. You can try to do things about that and manipulate the market, but that can just have unintended consequences. And you can try to do things where you try to help people, you know, by bunging them free cash, like Help to Buy and all those kinds of things. But that can just have unintended consequences. You can argue that you need to build more houses, but a lot of the product of this massive house price growth over the past decade, some of it is the product of not enough houses being built. Most of it is the product of dirt cheap mortgage rates and people being able to continue to pay ever, ever higher prices, not because their wages are going up, but because mortgage rates were going down, and that meant that they could borrow more and more money. Mortgage rates have gone up now, so the big question is, what will happen next? I suspect what will happen next is that house prices won't double again in the next 10 years. I mean, God hopes they don't.
Helen, do you think we're ever going to see prices rise so quickly in such a short time? Double?
Definitely not for quite some time. I think that big rise that we saw during the pandemic, that was a kind of once in a generation thing, in my opinion. It was a really unique set of circumstances, wasn't it, where people's housing needs changed quite drastically almost overnight. A lot of people who were lucky enough to stay in jobs managed to save quite a lot of money. So there was a lot of extra cash floating around. You know, we're not going to see that scenario again. I hope we're not going to see that scenario again for quite some time, I think. And actually looking at a lot of the places on that list, like sort of Hastings, Margate, they're places that a lot of people moved out of cities too, because they had that space and they were by the sea and they could afford a bigger house. And I think that's what really ramped up prices. So no, I think I don't think we're going to see that for quite some time. You know, there's always this theory that property kind of works in cycles. So in the article, Anisha Beveridge from Hamptons, she said, "We think the current property cycle will come to a close in the next few years, and from 2025 we expect history to repeat itself." But I think there she's talking about history pre-pandemic, because I don't think that happened.
What history is she talking about there?
Well, I think just the general kind of cycle of, I mean, property prices never really go down drastically, do they, on the whole? You know, a period of kind of rises and then kind of settling down and then rise again is essentially how house prices tend to go, bar any big sort of economic shocks, I think. I think we'll see a flattening of house prices over the next couple of years, maybe small falls in some areas, and like this research shows, you know, perhaps some bigger rises in others. It's quite a localized thing, you know, like you said, the house prices indexes will always show different things depending on what they're looking at. There'll be winners, there'll be losers, but I don't think we'll see huge rises like that for quite some time.
All right then, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North for our weekly update on what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Yeah, hi Simon. Even though for many parts of the world this was a shortened week because of the bank holiday we had for Easter, there's still plenty to talk about. The first thing to say is the S&P 500 is on course for its fifth positive week in a row. There was no negative surprises with the inflation number out of the US, which is still showing signs it's moving in the right direction. The bank earnings out of the US were pretty positive too, and there was no surprises from the FOMC minutes and the Bank of Canada policy announcement. On this side of the pond, the FTSE is on course for its fourth positive week in a row and is back again within touching distance of its all-time high ahead of a very data-heavy week next week. April historically is a very good month for equity markets, and right now that looks set to continue.
And what do we have to look forward to next week?
Yeah, next week, as I mentioned just now, earnings season is kicking off again. Some of the companies reporting next week include well-known names like Charles Schwab, Tesla, L'Oreal, Morgan Stanley, and American Express. From a scheduled macro point of view, we have Chinese GDP from quarter one, the UK jobs report, inflation number, retail sales number, and flash PMIs. So a busy week for the UK. Elsewhere, we have flash PMIs from Europe and the US, as well as Japanese CPI. We are now less than 3 weeks away from the rate decision from the US. So I would keep an eye and ear to the ground for any commentary from the Fed officials before their blackout period. But to be honest, after surviving another week, the main focus from now for the next couple of weeks or so will be how earnings do in comparison to the relatively low expectations. But right now, everything seems pretty good.
Thank you very much, Sam. Speak to you next week.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Now, in Simon's thought piece this week, it's all about the UK stock market. It looks cheap, he says, but will investors who back it finally get luck on their side? Simon, what has got you musing about this?
Well, a couple of things, really. So there was a new equity lens look at the stock markets from Schroders that I saw this week. And it looked at stock market valuations in various sort of major markets. And it had a dashboard on which it looked at whether they were cheap or expensive. Now, it's always very dangerous looking at just one of these things, one of these measures, because it can be skewed. But if you look across five of them, as they had done here, then, and they all tend to show up a similar thing, then you can reasonably say that a market looks relatively cheap. So it looked at the US, the UK, Europe, excluding the UK, Japan and emerging markets. And it compared the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, which is a way of looking at price to earnings, which is a way of measuring the cost of a share or a stock market, which basically looks at how much you're paying for a given year's earnings. And the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, which is called CAPE, sort of smooths that out over a 10-year period to try to allow for the business cycle and stuff like that. It looks at forward price to earnings, i.e. what you're paying for a company or a market based on what the profits that company or market is forecast to make in the next year. It looks at trailing price to earnings, i.e. what they made last year in that price. It looks at price to book, how much you're paying for that company compared to its value. And it looks at the dividend yield, what income you're getting from the company or the market. And if you look at the US, it is a sea of red. And then it compared these to their 15-year median, okay, so a percentage or above. And it ranked them into cheap, neutral, or expensive. Traffic light system, red, expensive. The US is a sea of red. Europe is a mix of red, amber, and a little bit of green. But the ones that stand out as cheap are the UK, Japan, and emerging markets. Now, the UK one is interesting to us because we're in the UK, but it's also interesting because there's lots of fund managers out there who invest in the UK. And so you've got to remember that they are talking their own book here, who have been making comments about how the market is as cheap as they have ever seen it, or as cheap as it was back in 2008/9. And there is an argument that says if you buy a market when it's cheap, then you give yourself a much better chance of doing well. You certainly give yourself more headroom for gains. So for example, one of these fund managers, Mark Slater, he's been a fund manager for 30 odd years. He runs the Slater Growth Income and Recovery Funds, wrote in a recent note to investors, "We have not seen so many companies we own trade on single digit price to earnings multiples since 2008, 2009. Now, as then, as companies grow their earnings while their multiples fall, they are getting cheaper and cheaper. It is analogous to holding a beach ball underwater. Sooner or later, you cannot hold it down any water and it jumps above the water. For a more accurate analogy, someone would also be pumping air into the beach ball while you try to keep it down." So the argument is the market's going to suddenly spring back and everybody's going to go, right, I'm going to buy these cheap shares. This is great. And the UK stock market and the UK companies and then the UK stock market, therefore, as a measure of UK companies overall, is going to do really well. This echoes the view of Temple Bar manager Ian Lance, who I did an investing show with late last year, who said that 2000 and 2008 was the last time he had seen UK shares at such bargain levels. There is a caveat here, though, and this is why I wrote at the start of my column, which is that if I'd had a pound for every time I'd read that the UK stock market is cheap, I would probably have made significantly more money than I have done in backing those supposedly bargain UK shares over the past decade or so, because I've invested in those cheap UK shares and I've watched as those more expensive US shares have done much, 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 much better. There is an argument that eventually this will reverse, the UK will do very well. You can spend a long time waiting for this supposedly cheap stuff to do well, and there's an opportunity cost, and the opportunity cost is that you missed out all the gains that those expensive companies over in the US made. So what do you do? Well, I think firstly you need to remember that if you're going to go trying to buy bargain shares, you need to be patient, so the patience that I just talked about. But you also need to recognize that there is an opportunity cost and that, you know, potentially other stuff is going to do well, which then leads into the fact that you need to diversify. You need to be careful how much of a portfolio you allocate to a market like the UK. It makes up just 5.7% of the global stock market. So if you've got more than 5.7% of your portfolio invested in UK shares, you are what is known in the trade as overweight the UK, i.e. you are more exposed to the UK than a kind of neutral level. Now that's fine if you think the UK is going to do well, but if you've got 80% in the UK, then just think about quite how much you are backing the UK versus the rest of the world when it's actually only 5.7% of the global stock market and the US stock market makes up 54% of the global stock market. It's very easy to become more heavily invested in a relatively small market than you think. And then also pick your investments carefully, because the temptation is to just pick out some shares. And then when they do really well, you'll make out like a bandit and you'll be really happy. But you need to build a diversified portfolio of them. You need at least 15 to 20 companies that do different things, that aren't all exposed to the same thing. That requires quite a lot of work and then keeping an eye on all those things. So a safer bet is a fund or an investment trust. But then the temptation is to go for an active fund or an active investment trust, you know, where the manager you think is going to beat the market. But by trying to find a manager who beats the market, you run the risk of picking one who doesn't. You might end up with a Neil Woodford. I mean, hopefully not. So you maybe need to think about, well, is it better getting a tracker instead? It won't beat the market, but it won't fall massively behind the market, hopefully. And actually, before you buy any investment, you should do that Marie Kondo thing where you hold it up and ask, does it bring me joy? You should hold it up and say, does it bring me anything that just investing my money in a cheap global tracker fund won't do, which doesn't have quite the same catchy ring to it as the Marie Kondo thing. But you get my analogy there. It's a similar idea. And for many people, actually, the best long-term gains would come from keeping it simple and just investing into a simple global tracker fund, or putting most of their money into that and then having that as the core part of their portfolio, and then having some more sort of satellite investments around that where they go for the stuff they think is going to outperform, rather than focusing their entire portfolio on the things that they think are going to outperform, and then they look back on it in a few years' time and they discover that actually they should have just gone for the boring old global tracker fund.
Nothing wrong with boring, eh? Right. Crane is back on the case, helping fight readers' corners. This time, it is about one reader who was locked out of their BA Executive Club account due to suspicious activity. They wanted to know, that's why they got in contact with Helen, have they lost their 650,000 Avios points? Firstly, Helen, for anyone who doesn't know Avios points, what are they? And is this a significant figure? What can it get you? I have just checked, 14,500.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to get you that much. I think I checked when I was doing this run, I have about 4,000, which is probably enough for, I don't know, a can of Coke on a plane or something. Nothing. Pitiful, pitiful amounts of points. So Avios points are the loyalty points which people earn when they take flights with BA. There's a real kind of cult following around them. So frequent flyers love collecting these points. People have like hundreds of thousands, some people, and you can basically collect them and you can spend them on flights or upgrades. So what they get you kind of depends on what you spend them on. The best way to spend them is supposed to be on business class and first class flights, because that gets you the best deal. You know, you kind of save, you get the most monetary value per point. So this person had 650,000 Avios points. I looked up what this would get him. So if he spent it on business or first class flights, they would be worth more than £13,000. And if he spent them on upgrades, they'd be worth up to £16,000. So it's actually huge sums of money. I think, you know, some people read that, oh, someone's lost some points, big deal. But that is a massive amount of money. And when you think, you know, BA don't offer this as a favor to customers. He's earned these points because he's booked lots of flights to BA, probably spent more money than if he would have booked those flights with other airlines. So, you know, he's paid a premium to fly with BA, collect those points. And, you know, this is a huge amount of money that he's missing. So, yeah, pleased that he wrote in and pleased that I could look into it for him. So what happened was he'd been locked out of his Executive Club account, which is an online account which people use to manage their Avios points and to book flights using them. So this went on for quite a few months. He got an email basically saying that they'd noticed some unusual activity on his account, but no explanation as to what this was. That was back in October last year. And he wrote to me in March and hadn't had any contact from them, hadn't been able to work out what was going on.
Is that common, Helen? Have you ever heard anyone else locked out of their executive accounts?
Yeah, well, actually, since I wrote the story, a couple of people have emailed to say some sort of things happened to them. And I think it's, you know, like with a lot of different accounts, it happens to people sometimes with bank accounts and things like that. Organisations will do sort of routine fraud checks, and they can flag up things like, I don't know, if you've kind of changed your details on your account maybe, or if there's been some activity on it that is something that you wouldn't ordinarily do. It's kind of, it can be a sort of a computer says no thing, like it flags up something that's unusual, and then the company will often automatically will lock your account.
Is 650,000 points unusual, or is it quite common that people can build up this amount? I'm just wondering if that was something that they flagged up. Too many points.
No, I don't think so, because this person, he said he's been flying with BA for 20 years. So he's clearly built up these points over a huge amount of time. It's not like he suddenly just got hundreds of thousands more points. And one thing he did say was he changed the email address on his account, and he thought that might be the reason that it's been shut down. But as often with these fraud checks, the company won't tell you why they've locked your account, obviously, because that might give people a way to kind of get around it, and they don't want to give away what their kind of systems are to maybe, because that would maybe, you know, teach fraudsters how to kind of game the system. But I think really this is kind of a customer service story, right? So these collectors are hugely loyal to BA. And they basically fobbed him off. They just didn't get back to him for months and months. And, you know, he's got the equivalent of £16,000 in his account. So he's understandably, you know, very concerned about potentially losing all those points. And I think you're just looking at the comments on the article. I think a lot of BA customers are really disappointed with their customer service. You know, it used to be one of those businesses really known for, you know, you fly with BA because it's a great experience. They treat their customers really well. And it seems like that's just not happening anymore. So this reader was basically ignored for quite a few months, had to come to me in order to get them to kind of pick up the phone and sort it out. When I spoke to them, almost disappointingly, it was just a human error. Basically, someone had just forgotten to get back to him or forgotten to unlock his account, but they hadn't told him about that for months. They did unlock it. He's got his points, which is great. He just had to send in a form of ID, which he'd actually done previously, but they hadn't got back to him. So it's all sorted. He's got into his account, but quite disappointed. I thought they might give him a few bonus avios to save somebody, but they didn't, which is a shame. But there we go.
At least he's back in his account. But yeah, no, I agree. I think if it's human error, they should make some sort of recompense for it. But there you go. Helen, you also, yin and yang, you like to promote the good news stories as well, the good customer service and the like. What have you found this week?
Yeah, so I always ask for good customer service stories. I must say recently, I haven't got very many at all. I don't know if it's because like customers are just feeling a bit kind of down on things, you know, not really feeling in the mood to kind of praise companies when the cost of everything is going up. But I did get a nice story this week, which is from someone who had bought a rucksack, like a travel rucksack from Tumi, which is a travel kind of luggage retailer. He bought it 15 years ago. And it was still going strong. These bags are kind of relatively expensive, so you can expect to pay a few hundred pounds for a bag from Tumi. But recently the zip gave out. He got in touch with them basically to ask if it could be repaired, which is quite nice, you know, that sort of eco-friendly ethos of, you know, let's not throw something away, let's see if we can fix it. They said they couldn't because they didn't sell that bag anymore, so they didn't have the right parts. But they did give him a voucher for £75 towards a new bag, which I think is very, very reasonable of them. That's, you know, I think that's a good move. Do the right thing and, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle. And they're, you know, keeping him as a customer. So I think it's a nice little customer service story.
Yeah, I think that's rather nice, isn't it? And if you don't ask, you don't get. So there you go. Finally, the unlikely cars becoming classics in 2023. Ford Orion, Austin Maestro and Vauxhall Nova, among 10 cars that turn 40 this year and earn historical vehicle status. But will they go up in value? Simon, someone asked me the other day, what makes a classic car a classic car? Absolutely no idea. And now I've got historical vehicle status thrown into the mix. Totally confused.
There is nothing that makes a classic car officially. Right. There is this, within the system, there is this historic vehicle exemption, which happens when a car reaches their 40th birthday. It means that they no longer need to pay car tax. They don't require an annual MOT either. And this is down to the low volume of surviving cars. And this is actually quite a controversial thing amongst those in the car world who argue, many of them argue, that actually you should be MOTing these cars every single year. And actually there are many people who have over 40 year old classic cars who do get them MOTed every year anyway, just because it's a road safety test and they think that they should do so. The argument is that they're cherished by their owners, they're maintained to a high standard, so they don't need the MOT and they don't do many miles. I mean, there's lots of people who still get the MOT done, but it is one way of saying, well, that's a classic because it's more than 40 years old. You don't have to pay you, Les, either. Sadiq Khan judges that to be the classic status. What's more a judge of a car being a classic is that it is in some way special or cherished, and the specialness matters more, or unusual, rare, that kind of thing. The specialness matters more and the rarity when they are brand new. So for example, you could have a car that becomes an almost instant classic because there's just not that many of them, although they are pretty special. You get things that are referred to as modern classics. That's a more recent classic car, but you could be talking about a 10, 15 year old car there. Or once they start to get older and older, then the what were actually very commonplace cars start to become much, much rarer. And then if you've got one and it's been kept in good nick, it becomes a classic. And there are shows like the Haggerty's Festival of the Unexceptional, where they celebrate those kind of everyday cars, the cars that your parents had when you were a kid that you just don't see anymore.
Burgundy, I mean, Volvo.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. When you were 11 years old and you were wandering around looking at cars, that Volvo estate, it wasn't a classic. It was just a boxy Volvo.
It was very boxy.
That you thought marked out your parents or your parents' friends as particularly uncool because they hadn't got a more sort of sporting looking car. All of a sudden, straight lined wedgy Volvos start to look quite cool. And you don't see many of them anymore. And then there's only a few of them left. And then all of a sudden, the ones that are left that are in really good condition, you go, you know what? That's a classic. That is a classic Volvo. Sierras. I mean, once upon a time, you couldn't move for falling over Sierras. You hardly ever see a Ford Sierra nowadays. If you see a Ford Sierra in the eye of many people, that is now a classic. But on this list, we've got a number of cars that are turning 40 this year, or the first variation of them are turning 40. Alfa Romeo 33, that is a very boxy looking car. The Austin Maestro, I mean, a Maestro. Once upon a time, you would have hung your head in shame and gone, oh my God, I've got to go in the Maestro. Or you would have been the very proud owner of the Maestro and gone, I love my Maestro. You just don't see them nowadays. Those are now 40 years old. Make you feel old yet? Fiat Uno, Ford Fiesta Mark II, the Ford Orion, the Escort with a boot. You've got to love that old-fashioned thing of, here's a hatchback, let's stick a boot on it and flog it to people under a different name. The Land Rover Defender, I mean, that's a bona fide classic. One after my heart, the Peugeot 205. Not the GTI. That's a bona fide modern classic, but the actual bog standard Peugeot 205 is turning 40 years old this year. The Toyota AE86, which was actually a sporting Toyota Corolla, which is actually hugely popular amongst those into the sort of Japanese car scene. And the Vauxhall Nova, which must deserve a special mention for all those who've been Nova taken or seen one with a sticker in the back talking about a Nova dose. Yes, the Vauxhall Nova, beloved by old grannies, mums taking their kids to school, and then boy racers who stuck half of Halfords onto the outside of it in the mistaken belief that it would make people think that their 1.1 litre Nova went faster. That's now 40 years old. And there are fewer than 1,000 left on the roads today. Mm. And I mean, you know, basically that's a you take a Nova to a classic car show, I guarantee you will have as many people come up and talk to you as the person just down the road with their Ferrari. It's that wonderful effect of these commonplace cars you don't see anymore. And then the Mark II Golf.
Right. Yeah. I'll be honest with you, Simon. I've reached 40. I'd like to think I look a darn sight better than all of these cars on here. If you have a chance to take a look, do. I'm blown away by none of them, Simon. None of them. No. I mean, the Toyota AE86.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that's quite cool. The rest, I mean, the Peugeot 205, please. Land Rover's all right. But anyway, take a look. See if you're more blown away by these than me. How much are these going for, Simon? Just out of throw the one that I said was the most ridiculous one, the Peugeot. How much is that going for, roughly? I had a Peugeot Estate was my first car.
But that very much depends on what Peugeot 205 it is. I mean,
this one here,
which is a fairly bog standard Peugeot 205 Zest, in good condition.
Yeah.
In the kind of condition that car is pictured in, which, bear in mind that picture that's a K-Reg car. So I've got suspicion that picture was taken when the K-Reg came out. Yeah. Not recently. That's not a K-Reg car in that kind of condition. But if you had that car in that almost as new condition, it would be worth thousands. Even a bog standard 205 would be worth maybe $4,000 in that kind of condition. If you had a 205 GTI in that kind of condition that had done low mileage, you might be looking at £30,000. But if you had a 205 GTI that's done, 150,000 miles and is in reasonable condition, but not, showroom fresh, minty, kind of what they call concourse condition, that might be worth maybe 12, something like that, says a man who might know the answer to that question.
Goodness, it's more than my car. Right. Well, that's it. Thank you very much, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to link into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk or you can tweet us at thisismoney or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read comments.
Marvellous. Thank you, of course, to Helen. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.